Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to A Good Football Show. I am Patrick Daugherty, joined by Patrick Corain, and today we will be continuing our division preview series with the NFC West. We will be joined by NBC Sports Bay Area's Matt Maiocco to discuss the 49ers and the Athletics' Michael Sean Duggar to talk about the Seahawks. Corain and I will then dive into the Rams and Cardinals. But Matt, thank you so much for joining us, and I can't even tell you how many different times we have cited you here on this website at rotoworld.com. You have been on the 49ers beat for basically the life of our site and have to be one of the most cited people in the history of rotoworld.com. We really, really appreciate all the news, scoops, and analysis over the years.
Well, thank you for those kind words. And yeah, I think I probably started covering the 49ers when you two weren't even about the life of the website, probably the life of both of you guys. You know what? This is going to be one of the more fascinating training camps for the 49ers in the time that I've covered, because, you know, there's stuff going on. You know, there's Debo Samuel stuff. There's Jimmy Garoppolo stuff. There's Trey Lance stuff. And, you know, not in my lifetime have they traded up and made that move that they made last year to go get their quarterback. And this is the summer that we really start to see, you know, that transition now to Trey Lance. And it's anybody's guess how he's going to fare.
So, yeah, we'll just start there, because like the 49ers, a team that's made the NFC Championship game two times in the past 3 years, I think it's unusual for a team in that position to have so many major question marks. And this, we'll start at quarterback, where, you know, this is now year two of what I assume is this never-ending quarterback questions for you. And it was reported 5 days ago the Niners have finally given Jimmy Garoppolo formal permission to request a trade. I mean,
I'm going to cut you off a little bit here. We reported that back in March.
That's what I was going to say. And like,
I'm not sure why that came out last week the way it did nationally, but John Lynch told me at the owners' meetings March 28th that they had given permission. And of course, I mean, there was no secret. 49ers were intent on trading Jimmy Garoppolo. So whenever you make that, you know, it was a foregone conclusion that they were going to try to trade him. And Jimmy Garoppolo, 2 days after the NFC Championship game, when the 49ers lost, their season was over, he basically said goodbye to everybody. So they were going to have them involved in this every step of the way. Of course, you know, the shoulder surgery happened, and that derailed everything. I think the 49ers would have been able to trade him on the first day of the new league year. But one thing I've learned is that teams that trade for quarterbacks want their quarterback to be able to throw a football. And that hasn't been the case, but he is rehabbing now, going through physical therapy. And the expectation is that, you know, well, I don't know what the expectation is. I mean, he's going to be cleared soon enough. Maybe we'll see. I mean, he's throwing, but, you know, how he ends up on another team, if he ends up on another team, all that stuff remains up in the air.
See, that veteran experience for me, by the way, that teams usually want their quarterback to be able to throw a football. So,
well, you said if he ends up on another team there, and I think there's still a little bit of a discount in fantasy drafts on Trey Lance, as people are worried that maybe Jimmy does stick around on this roster. But I would imagine he'd have to take like a really big pay cut for that to happen. Or is there a chance that, you know, they work something out where he sticks around, or is this kind of a situation where it's best for all parties if he moves on?
Well, now publicly, John Lynch has said, you know, we don't plan to release him because you don't get rid of good football players. And, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo is a good football player. However, I mean, let's look at the NFL landscape. Every season, good football players are being released by their teams because they make too much money. And that would certainly be the situation here where, you know, the 49ers have some of the absolute top players in the game at their positions, and they're paid like it. You know, guys like Eric Armstead, guys like Fred Warner, George Kittle, Trent Williams, those guys' salaries are rising in these future years. They're going to have to pay Deebo Samuel. They're going to have to pay Nick Bosa. So do you really have 20, and I'm talking to the 49ers, do they really have $24 million just to burn on a backup quarterback as a really good insurance policy, but a very costly insurance policy? So yes, the 49ers want to trade Jimmy Garoppolo. Kyle Shanahan said a month ago that he still expects Jimmy Garoppolo to be traded before the start of the season. When you've already kind of put that out there, haven't you already kind of moved on from that quarterback? The question is, who's going to trade for him with that salary? And with so few starting positions at the quarterback spot available right now, I don't see any team trading for him. So if he does, if he comes back to the 49ers, I mean, would he accept a pay cut? You know, he used the term, you know, that I wouldn't wish, you know, last year on my worst enemy, because it was a really difficult season for him. So would he want to come back to the 49ers and now in a role where he's the backup? I don't think so. I think he wants a fresh start. I think he wants to go someplace where he thinks that there's at least a chance to have a future there. But I mean, all this stuff still is unresolved and remains to be seen. And the 49ers certainly don't want to give off the indication that if they don't get a trade partner by whatever, you know, by August 1, they're going to release him, because then obviously no team would trade for him. But I'm very skeptical that right now any team's going to trade for him.
If he somehow remains on the roster by week one, I mean, there's no controversy, right? Like the 49ers, have they turned the page on the field and they are now officially all in on Trey Lance, like you said, who they made the big, big move for, number three overall. Like, even if, say, Jimmy G, like, this, I don't know, doesn't show teams what they need to see with his shoulder and he remains on the roster, there's no controversy here, right?
You're saying if he stays with the 49ers?
Yes, if he somehow remains in the 49ers roster.
I think there will be a controversy. I think as long as Jimmy Garoppolo is there, there's going to be a controversy. And maybe not, I mean, we all realize that it's not going to be smooth sailing for Trey Lance. You know, it's never smooth sailing for any first-year starting quarterback. Well, I guess Patrick Mahomes had a pretty smooth, what was that, in 2018?
2018, he was the model breaker.
So. Yeah. But you can't expect that from any other quarterback. I mean, you know, Josh Allen struggled as a rookie, struggled as a second-year quarterback, and then third year, you know, blows up. So what I'm saying is, if Jimmy Garoppolo remains on the team, however he remains on the team, whether he's making his 24.2 or whether it's cut down to 12 million or whatever the case may be, if the 49ers struggle early in the season, lose two consecutive games, I mean, this is a team that's ready to win now at every position, maybe with the exception of quarterback. So if quarterback is part of the reason why they lose, I mean, heck, if they lose to the Bears week one, week two against Seattle becomes a must-win game. And people will be going, oh, they don't have time to wait for Trey Lance because they need to get Jimmy Garoppolo. You know what you're getting with Jimmy Garoppolo. So I think there will be that conversation early in the season if Trey Lance struggles. So that's why I think just emotionally – It makes more sense in my mind to just go all in with Trey Lance with no safety net, because if you have to bench Trey Lance at any point this season, then that number three overall pick isn't looking so good. And now the future really starts to become in question, because now you have to rebuild that kid's confidence. And I don't know. I just have a hard time believing that there's much of a chance that the season starts and Jimmy Garoppolo's on the 49ers.
Yeah, you immediately highlighted just how naive my question was. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there will be controversy, I guess, if Jimmy Garoppolo remains in the roster.
Well, and I'll tell you this. You know, there's a good percentage of the 49ers fan base who thinks, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo's the best quarterback ever. There's also a decent-sized percentage of the fan base who believes that Jimmy Garoppolo's the worst quarterback ever. So there's always going to be this and he's a very – I mean, he's somebody that people – they love to talk about him. He's always, he always captures your eye wherever he is. And so it would just be a huge distraction and a lot of drama if he remains in the building.
Yeah, I think you just highlighted the duality of fan there. Matt, you've mentioned Deebo Samuel a few times. He's coming off one of the most unique seasons in recent NFL history. But you know, there's trouble in paradise this offseason. There was Instagram drama. Trade requests, unclear if they've been formally rescinded. He's on the 49ers. He seems to be on the 49ers to stay for 2022. Just what is the state of this relationship right now, and how might Debo's role change this season, if at all?
Yeah, I would say the 49ers, I don't know that Deebo Samuel has said, oh, by the way, don't try to trade me. But the 49ers internally have, you know, basically ended all talks, and you know that kind of heated up around the draft. You know, once the first day of the NFL draft came and went, then you know there weren't any trade conversations. The interesting thing you mentioned, like the Instagram stuff, which is
sorry about our generations.
Well, hey, no, that's my generation now too.
It's true. It actually is. It's everyone's generation now. We all have to apologize to each other for our online.
The first signs that Deebo Samuel was dissatisfied with the team was when he scrubbed his IG account of all mentions of the 49ers. And so he requested a trade. He's never said why he's upset or was upset. He, you know, there's been speculation. You know, is it his role as, you know, a dual threat wide receiver, pass catcher, runner? He's never said that. He has a very good relationship with Kyle Shanahan. And so if he had an issue with his role, how he's being used, he has the open door policy. He and Kyle Shanahan would speak every, you know, for hours every Tuesday during the season, kind of going over stuff and talking about life and football and everything else. So it's not like he didn't know who to talk to about his evolving role last season. So we really don't know exactly what drove him to request that trade. I'm not sure we will. I don't know that he's going to be forthright when training camp opens. Now, he did come to the mandatory mini camp, which to me was a signal that maybe, you know, the frost is thawing a little bit. And he looked, if you didn't know that he had requested a trade, you never would have been able to figure out that there was anything wrong, because he was smiling, he was joking, he was conversing with teammates on both sides of the ball. But with training camp opening, Deebo Samuel is grossly underpaid, scheduled to make $4 million this year. He should be making five or six times that amount. I can't imagine that he will step on the practice field without a new contract. And I would think that the 49ers understand that, and they probably don't want him to step on the field without a new contract. They don't need him to be on the field and practicing and playing in preseason games. They need him September 11th when the 49ers open against the Bears. And how they use him remains to be seen. I would think, because they have more depth now at the running back position, that they won't need to put him in the backfield. I mean, they did it last year by necessity. You know, other than Elijah Mitchell last year, they really didn't have a running back that last year they felt comfortable with and confident in. And so they felt like, you know, their second best running back, and heck, at times maybe even their best running back, was Deebo Samuel. I would fully expect, you know, this year he'll you know, handle the ball on a few jet sweeps, but I don't think you'll see him in the backfield, because they just have so many other options in the backfield. When you talk about Elijah Mitchell, they drafted Ty Davis Price. Jeff Wilson's a lot more healthy than he was last year. And then Trey Sermon is back year two to see if he can make an impact on that offense. So we'll see how this turns out. But I still expect that Deebo Samuel will be signing a long-term extension with the 49ers because, frankly, I don't see any other option for him or the team.
We want to ask you a bit more about the receiving core, but you know, you mentioned the backfield and you know, how that Deebo role might not be as necessary. How do you view the secondary running back for the 49ers? I mean, we expect that Mitchell will be leading a committee, but reports have been that Jeff Wilson is still the number two guy, but they drafted Tyrion Davis Price, who fantasy drafters are expecting will be the number two this year. They're drafting him well ahead of Wilson. And then Trey Sermon is still in the mix. Is he, you know, someone that we should just be forgetting about, or is he, does he have a chance to challenge for this number two role at some point?
No, I think those three guys that you mentioned behind Elijah Mitchell go into this with something to prove. Each of them has something to prove. And it, you know, it's a cliche, but it'll be decided in training camp. You know, there wasn't too many people last year that envisioned Elijah Mitchell being the number two guy behind Raheem Mostert. And I certainly didn't leading up to week one because, you know, Elijah Mitchell missed most of training camp with an adductor injury. And he only carried the ball six times in the preseason. And so what the 49ers saw behind the scenes in those limited reps and probably his knowledge and decisiveness in that system led them to just have him leapfrog everybody else and become the number two back. So, you know, you mentioned Davis Price. If he steps in, you know, he's a big guy. He's, you know, probably the more of all those guys, I guess he and, well, yeah, I mean, he's a big guy. He looks like more of an every down back than Elijah Mitchell does just from his size. And Mitchell took a beating last year. He missed six games with a variety of injuries. So I don't know that they want him to have that kind of workload that he had last season. I think they are in a better position now to have maybe not necessarily a backs by committee, but at least two backs who they can kind of use interchangeably. And, you know, a third back will probably be active for games. And so that means, you know, Davis Price, Wilson, or Sermon, one of those three won't be active. So they go into this, though, with a lot more depth than they've had in quite a while at that position. But how it shakes out at this point is still pretty much up in the air, other than we know that Elijah Mitchell, when healthy, is going to factor prominently into what they do offensively.
You just very eloquently put basically how Kyle Shanahan's a black box, kind of when it comes to the use, especially this time of year, where said he took even the 49ers media by surprise with Elijah Mitchell. But I mean, if you had to guess, and we understand that it could be just a literal guess, who would see the second most touches in the 49ers?
This is a guess. It would be a Ty Davis Price because they drafted him in the third round, right? I mean, if they didn't like him, you know, they've had such success getting running backs out of the undrafted class, right? I mean, you know, the Matt Breida, Jeff Wilson, you know, they take Elijah Mitchell in the sixth round. Now, it's almost to me when they took Trey Sermon last year in the third round, and then they took Mitchell, and Mitchell ended up being the main back, to then take another running back in the third round this year was almost to me kind of an admission of we messed up on Trey Sermon and we can't mess up on this guy. Like this guy, this is nothing, no knock necessarily on Trey Sermon, because I was hearing that, you know, they were happy with the work ethic and everything else, but it just didn't seem to be a natural fit in that offense. Whereas Elijah Mitchell, I mean, he stepped in and he was decisive. He knew, you know, it wasn't like he was thinking his way through. You know, he would see a hole, stick his foot in the ground and head upfield. So Trey Sermon, I think, got better with that, but still the fact that they take a running back in the third round 2 years in a row either can be an indictment on Trey Sermon or showing a lot of confidence that Ty Davis Price can be that guy. To me, it's kind of a combination of both. So that's why I would lean toward Davis Price being the number two guy.
Yeah, you mentioned the depth here being a real strength compared to last year. We're also looking at Trey Lance, presumably running quite a bit. I mean, he was running a ton, scrambling and design runs in, you know, his limited action last year. That's not going to leave a ton of passing attempts, most likely. But I wanted to get your thoughts on the rest of the pass catchers, because there's some really talented players here in Brandon Ayuk, George Kittle, Juwan Jennings potentially is the third guy. But how much passing volume is there going to be? And can Trey Lance's potential more frequent downfield throws help create some big plays to make up for a lack of passing volume? How do you view the rest of this passing game?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. I mean, I guess, you know, if the 49ers are winning football games, they're going to be running the ball more. You know, they want to run the ball 30 times a game. And to me and to them, they see that as it's almost a chicken and the egg thing. I mean, you run it because you're successful, but also if you're winning, you're going to be running more. You know, it's kind of a, you know, it's not necessarily just cause and effect, but they do have some weapons in the passing game. You know, Brandon Ayuk, after a really slow start last season, came on strong and really looked like a solid number two NFL receiver. Debo Samuel got off to a really good start in as far as a pass catcher before he moved into that kind of dual threat role. And then you have George Kittle. George Kittle can stay healthy. You know, those are three guys right there who are pushing 1,000 yards receiving. You know, they're all capable of doing that, but, you know, will there be enough, you know, are there enough footballs to go around to satisfy all three of those guys? And I think a major emphasis for Trey Lance will be, you know, making plays from the pocket and using those legs. There will certainly be designed runs, but, you know, it's making plays from the pocket and using his legs as almost kind of a last resort to bail them out of situations. Because right now, you know, with their offensive line, their interior offensive line, there are some questions about, you know, how that protection is going to hold up. But, you know, I think Juwan Jennings right now would be the number three guy. And he was very effective in red zone and third down situations, has a real knack for finding the sticks. And then you have Danny Gray, who's a speedster who can take the top off the defense. So there will be roles for all of those guys. And it's, you know, it's probably a good sign for Brandon Ayuk that pretty much everywhere Trey Lance went this offseason, Brandon Ayuk was right there. You know, so they built a nice rapport, nice chemistry through the offseason. That's something that Debo Samuel didn't have with Trey Lance this offseason.
Matt, thank you so much for taking the time. So much good stuff. Again, just a really complicated team. We're in a situation that probably shouldn't be complicated when the roster is so good. But that's just kind of the Shanahans for you. They like to up the degree of difficulty, I feel like.
They are. They've turned into, I think, probably as training camp opens, one of the more interesting teams in the league because of that, you know, that dichotomy of all these veteran guys who are playing it, you know, the highest levels at their positions, and then the complete unknown. And obviously, you know, the quarterback position, it's kind of an outsized impact teams. And so much is going to be riding on Trey Lance, unless, of course, they keep Jimmy Garoppolo around, and then there will be drama every week.
Yeah, well, we know there's going to be drama either way. It's going to be interesting every day. And check out Matt Maiocco on NBC Sports Bay Area on Twitter, Maiocco MBCS. Always great stuff. The 49er source. And we really appreciate you taking the time to join us today, Matt.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, you, Matt. So much to Matt. We'll be right back after this with The Athletic's Michael Sean Duggar. But first, a quick message.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com. TRUGREEN.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The Fantasy Football Expo presented by NBC Sports Edge is coming to Canton, Ohio, August 12th to 14th. Join some of the top experts in the country, including our very own myself, Pat Corain, Denny Carter, Lawrence Jackson, and Kyle Dvorak at the only true Fantasy Football Expo in the country. Tickets are available at thefantasyfootballexpo.com. Use promo code NBCPASS at checkout to save $20. It is now our pleasure to welcome in The Athletic's Michael Sean. And Michael, I'm already butchering your last name. I've been having my last name butchered my entire life as Darty. I've heard you say it's Duger. I'm so sorry to not be getting this correct. How do you say it?
Dugar.
Dugar, that's not difficult at all, actually. but I'm sure you're looking forward to what is this guaranteed to be a couple of normal weeks at Seahawks camp. Nothing weird ever going on with this team. And you're settling in for what will probably be another crazy summer with Pete Carroll.
Yeah, it's our first quarterback battle ever, really, since I've been covering the team. You know, because I started in 2017, so Russell was already pretty established there. And there weren't that many even interesting position battles since I got here. You know, it was like fifth receiver, backup running back, you know, maybe starting running back a couple years, maybe some tackle spots here and there. But then Dwayne Brown settled that. And even Jermaine Ifedi, as streaky as he was, never really had any competition. So, like, legitimately we get, like, an intriguing competition at the most important spot and the most intriguing spot on the field, even though – neither guy is like a Pro Bowl caliber dude. Like, that'll be kind of, you know, semi fun to follow all summer.
Yeah, like you said, it's for a team that's kind of had, yeah, some drama and kind of like fading from some of their playoff glories. It has been a pretty like set depth chart, especially on offense, especially with the top weapons. But like you said, after a decade, there's a quarterback competition. Let's get right to it. I mean, you might be guessing, like maybe everyone's guessing, but if the season were starting today, would it be Drew Lock or would it be Geno Smith?
I think it would be Geno Smith. I just think Geno is a little better. He protects the ball a little better throughout the course of his career, and you saw a little bit of that when he was starting for Russell Wilson those three games last year. I know he threw a pick in his first appearance against the Rams, though Tyler Lockett it fell down, so kind of is what it is. But, like, Drew led the league in interceptions like 2 years ago.
Yes.
So, Geno protects the ball a little better. Neither one of them pushes it downfield super far, which will be an issue, I think. But Geno knows the system. You know, he knows how to throw to Tyler Lockett. He knows how to throw to DK Metcalf. And I know people may hear that and say, "What well, I could throw to DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett." But there is a level of chemistry associated, you know, with the quarterback and receiver relationship. You know, Geno spoke about that a little bit. I think that was in June. Because if you notice, he just was not getting Tyler the ball at a high level. Fantasy players know this for sure. In weeks 6 and 7 against the Saints and against the Steelers, and then all of a sudden against the Jaguars, he and Tyler just looked like Russ and Tyler. You know, now some of that is because the Jaguars were putting out an XFL defense for a minute there. But Geno specifically was like, yo, it took us a few weeks because we just had to get the rhythm. When you're the backup quarterback behind an Iron Man like Russ, you don't get any reps. Russ ain't giving up no reps in practice. He doesn't really miss any games. So Geno had maybe thrown only a handful of passes to Tyler with a defense, you know, against him. And that matters, you know, when you play in regular season games. So I think that'll help Geno win the competition over Drew in August.
Yeah, you talk about the Drew Lock turnovers. I'm a Mizzou alum and saw basically every one of Drew Lock's college starts. And it's a problem. He liked to throw the ball right to linebackers. Like, even when he was a superstar in the SEC, he would just uncork an interception like right to a linebacker, kind of like
great chemistry with linebackers.
Yeah, yeah, great chemistry with the middle linebacker in the SEC.
Yeah, Drew gets in trouble, man. I mean, and Josh Allen had this issue, and some of Mahomes' worst games are this issue as well. Like, guys with those big arms just think they can put it anywhere, you know, with any arm angle under duress, falling down, you know, across their body. They just think they can just, like, my arm can get it there. And with the other guys that I named, that is true. You know, Josh Allen can get it anywhere. Patrick Mahomes can get it anywhere. Even Aaron Rodgers can get it anywhere. You know, those guys who have just, like, a cannon. can just – Russell Wilson, too, can get it pretty much anywhere. He's got a really, really, really strong arm. But, like, when you don't – when you're doing that too often and you throw it to the other team, that's how you end up getting traded, you know. In, at least in Drew's case, Russ asked for a trade. But I think that's what's going to get Drew in trouble. It already got him in trouble a little bit in minicamp. You know, he threw probably the – between the two, they both protected the ball pretty well, but then, like, Drew made the worst mistake of camp, threw a pick six, you know, during, like, 11-on-11 or 7-on-7, which is really tough to do in that setting. It's all set up for the offense to score. But to Drew's credit, I will cut him a little slack, even though he made what I would call basically a rookie mistake. He had been watching film with one of the corners, Ugo Amadi, because they knew each other from draft training. They're in the same draft class. And they were kind of talking about ideas and scheme. And he was like, yeah, Ugo, if you do this, like, you better be careful because you flat-footed, I'm going to get you. And then Ugo just baited him into a pick six. And he was like, I'm going to stop watching film with Ugo, which probably shouldn't have been in the first place when you're trying to win the battle.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if I like Drew's process there.
if you're solidified, like Aaron Rodgers can watch film with Jair Alexander. Right, like they're fine there. That's a mutually beneficial experience. That's not for Drew. No. All that did was make Ugo look great.
Say, don't make the corner look good in 11-on-11, Drew. Not a good strategy to win a quarterback battle.
Well, assuming Geno does win the starting job, how much rope do you think he'll have? The Seahawks like seem pretty intrigued by Drew Lock. Seemed like that was like maybe an important part of the Russ Wilson trade to get Drew Lock back. Do you think like we might see this kind of like yo-yo between the two of them over the course of the season? Or, you know, could we see an extended stretch where Geno Smith is the starter if he's, you know, presumably not playing very poorly?
Yeah, I think he would have to play really bad to get yanked. I just think turnovers will do it, you know. If you're fumbling, you're throwing picks, if they're really bad ones too, like, you know, every tip isn't – every bad turnover isn't the same, you know. Some of them are like – a Hail Mary at the end of a half is an interception, right? But that doesn't really kill you as much as a pick six, right? You know, or pick at the goal line. You know, that's where I'm a stat nerd with stuff like EPA per play kind of takes into account the varying levels turnovers. You know, you get a strip sack, you know, that's something kind of fluky versus, you know, some other ones that are more like quarterback, what the hell are you doing? So I think Geno's going to have to turn it over a lot, and they're going to have to get, like, embarrassed in some games, I think. And which could happen easily.
It could.
They didn't get embarrassed in any last year. Like, even the ones Geno lost, they weren't embarrassed in any of those. They took the Steelers to overtime, lost to the Saints by 3 at home on Monday Night Football, and then smoked the Jags. So, like, they were fine. If that's the case, if Geno just plays like he did in those 3 starts last year, then Geno will start the whole year. Because that's just getting blown out just changes things for teams. Like, the owners don't like that. GMs don't like that. People paying for tickets don't like that. You know, the broadcast networks don't want to put you in fighting to flex you in if you're getting smoked, right? So I think that is something Seattle hasn't had to deal with consistently. Even, like, last year, they had, like, they might have had a positive point differential, but had a losing record. That pretty much means they were a competitive team versus, like, the Steelers and Raiders, whose point differential said they stunk, but still somehow made the playoffs, right? So I think for Geno to get the hook, he'd have to be quarterbacking some pretty embarrassing losses.
That makes me feel better because I'm kind of with you that I think Geno is the better quarterback, so I prefer he'd be in there. Because DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett are going to be interesting options in fantasy this year, what we're seeing from fantasy drafts so far is that people are much more confident in DK Metcalf. He's going 4 rounds ahead of Lockett in current fantasy drafts. Do you think that Metcalf can separate like that from Tyler Lockett, or is there kind of overconfidence in the fantasy community about the difference between what Metcalf's going to do this season versus Lockett?
Yeah, I think their numbers at the end of the year will look similar. They have in all 3 years they've played together. The difference is, as fantasy players know, is Tyler is real boom or bust. He will go a few weeks with, you know, 2 catches for 46 yards or something like that, and then randomly have like a 160. And 3 touchdowns or something like that, which is great for Tyler because it all averages out to show that you're a great player. But if you're trying to win a matchup in any given fantasy week, that does you no good. So I think that'll be a little bit more the same just because I don't think they'll have that many games where they score a lot of points. So you'll see DK have some games like 7 for 80 and a touch, and, you know, they lose 13-28 or something like that. It just doesn't leave a lot of room for Tyler to go crazy, and then they'll have some games, maybe 1 or 2, they blow some guys out, and then that's the – that's the Tyler Lockett game. So yeah, I can see why he's getting dropped. DK is getting drafted a lot higher, just because I think he's more likely to be consistent, that to get the 1,100 yards or whatever he'll have. He'll be right around whatever average that is over the course of 17 games, where if Tyler has 1,100, 500 of those might come over like three games or something like that. And then he'll be kind of ghost for a little bit. That's just kind of what he's been. Maybe that was a Russell thing. I'm not sure. But all we have to go on is Tyler's career this far. And like seven or eight seasons tells us that he's kind of been boom or bust.
Yeah, we hope
we call that veteran best ball is how we
and we hope that was Russell Wilson, because like you said, it'd be like three or four games of like four catches, 42 yards. Then he like flirts with like setting the single game receiving record.
Yeah. It's really, he had two games against Arizona, I think, in 2020.
Oh yeah, that was combined. A great fantasy meme. That was like the talk all year. He just needs to play the Cardinals again. He'll get 324 yards that game.
Yeah. He combined for like 400 or something against them in two games with like six touchdowns or something like that. It was ridiculous, those two games against them. But yeah, then he had some games against like the Vikings, too high teams that play too high coverage. Maybe that'll help fantasy. Teams that play too high, Tyler's not as adept at killing that for whatever reason. But then again, that could be a Russell thing. So I'm not sure if that holds true with the new quarterback.
So we know that Metcalf and Lockett, maybe we don't quite know what the order will be on any given week between Metcalf and Lockett, which has been typical for them. We know they're the top two. I mean, who is the clear number? Maybe not clear is not the right word. Who is the favorite to be the third passing game weapon? Is it Noah Fant coming over for the Broncos, or is it someone else? The fantasy community, I think, assumes it's going to be Noah Fant as the third passing game option, but is that reality?
Yeah, I think so. I think there'll be like a huge, like if I'm drafting, I'm in three leagues, so I mean, I get how the game goes. Like if you, I'm not a very good fantasy player though, let me preface that.
Same. Crane is really good.
Relative to my knowledge of football, I'm a decent player, but you would think that I watch film, I know stats, I'd have a leg up, but relative to my knowledge of football, my skill level was, the gap is pretty significant. But
you're spending too much time giving us actionable information and maybe not getting to act on it yourself.
Yeah, well, I overthink things too. Like that too high thing I mentioned, it'll be true every other game except the 1 week Tyler plays a too high team and has 170 yards, something like that. So I think there will be a gap though, in, put it this way, I don't think anybody on the Seahawks is worth having on your fantasy team other than Noah, DK, and Tyler. I think the drop-off after that is, like, stark. Kenneth Walker, maybe. But, you know, running backs, everybody plays fantasy knows, they just, one injury can just kill your whole team on there. But I think, yeah, those three are the guys to have, especially if you're in full-point PPR. Because I think Noah might be by far the number three receiver, like way ahead of Will Disley, way ahead of D. Eskridge, way ahead of Freddie Swain. Like I could see Noah being pass catcher three in this offense by a pretty significant margin. I think Gerald Everett was last year over Freddie Swain by a pretty good portion as well. And Gerald didn't even have that great of a year. Whereas I think Noah will get used a little bit more because quarterbacks that don't throw a ton downfield tend to throw to their tight ends a little bit, and running backs a little bit more. You see like Tom Brady's career trying to kind of,
yes,
reflects that a little bit. So yeah, I think Noah, DK, and Tyler in some order are your three pass catchers to have in Seattle's offense.
See, Crane is chomping at the bit to ask you about the backfield, but so you don't see maybe a potential second year move for D. Eskridge after kind of like the lost rookie season. You don't think he's gonna be able to force his way like into that top three mix?
No, I think it'll just be too tough because they're already one of the higher 12 personnel teams last year, according to True Media. I think they were like third or fourth in 12 personnel, top 10 at least, because they were pretty high in 11 personnel as well. So when you have two tight ends on the field, that means DK, that means Tyler, that means Noah, that means Will Disley. Well, you don't have a third receiver. And then the times you do have a third receiver on the field, well, you're probably throwing it to Tyler or DK or Noah anyway.
Yeah.
Right. Or dumping it to Rashad, screen pass to Kenneth Walker. I just don't see a lot of targets coming that third receiver's way. And for the most part, that holds true on most teams. Like I don't have the stat in front of me, but I'm pretty sure the number three receiver on any given offense probably averages, I don't know, probably like 500 yards or something like that. Maybe 30.
If they're lucky. It depends.
Yeah. 30, 40 catches, maybe, you know, like a number three receiver. Like I'm talking just receivers, not pass catcher. Like a third receiver doesn't really go crazy in any given offense. So I think that I would stay away from D. I'd stay away from Freddie. Not to say they can't be productive. I just don't think they'll be consistent enough to be worth having in your lineup unless you got a lot of injuries or a lot of bye weeks.
Yeah, the classic, better in real life than fantasy. Drew Lock, Drew Lock, Geno Smith aren't really known for going four or five weapons deep in fantasy. So that makes a lot of sense. Michael Sean, it appears the consensus, like I was going to say amongst Seahawks media, I don't really know who's creating this consensus, but is that right now Rashad Penny is safely ahead of second rounder Kenneth Walker for lead back duties. Is that your sense as well? And just how might the touches shake out between Rashad Penny and Kenneth Walker? You know, Rashad Penny was maybe the best running back in football the final 5 or 6 weeks of the season last year. And then Kenneth Walker with huge real life draft capital, you know, big time prospect. Just what is your early sense there? And how do you see the touches shaking out between them?
If Rashad is healthy, I don't see Kenneth getting a ton of burn early on. I guess we should, this is all, I should preface this by saying, this is assuming Chris Carson's neck injury prevents him from returning to the lineup. I think if Chris doesn't pass a physical here on Wednesday or whatever, he'll end up on the PUP list. And then it just becomes a more of a waiting game from there. So assuming Chris is on the shelf here, then yeah, I think Rashad will be the guy. Like, he'll be the starter if he stays healthy. But anyone who's been following the Seahawks for the last 4 years understands that that's no guaranteed, you know, proposition. Rashad made it through his rookie year with a few injuries and was okay. But then after that, it's just been injury, injury, injury. And then, yeah, he just turned into Barry Sanders for the final month of the season last year. But was that a blip? Was that a trend? You know, who knows? A lot of that's offensive line dependent. They could have three new starters on the line, you know, this year. So I can't really feel great about that because you're asking, there's just too many variables that Rashad can't control. It's staying healthy, and then it's the O-line's blocking. Two things I just don't feel great about right here on July, whatever day it is. So if he's healthy, though, I think he's the guy. The thing is, though, they like using the hot hand, too. So Kenneth gets in there because Rashad's tired, busts an 8-yarder, busts a 10-yarder, 11-yarder here. Rashad could be shelved the whole, you know, rest of the game. Yeah, who knows? But I think Rashad will get that first look just because he was so damn good, you know, to end the year last year.
You said Barry Sanders. He seriously looked like Adrian Peterson sometimes with some of these like long, powerful runs. And like that was one of the things always holding him back. I felt like injuries were the main thing holding him back, but he was never allowed to get into rhythm. And the first time he got into rhythm, he was amazing. And now they've like set up another situation where it's going to be very hard to get into rhythm with a second round.
Yeah, he's a rhythm rusher for sure. And he's been saying it for years. I've known it for years. Like, I was one of the people who didn't really have to ask Rashad, oh, what changed? What changed? I knew what changed. He was getting more touches. You look at all those years, even when he was hurt, look at the games where he had double-digit touches. He was doing his thing. He was finding the end zone. He was at, like, 4, 5, 6 yards a pop. Like, he was being productive when he got the ops. It was the games where he had like 3 carries for 8 yards and was like, well, yeah, man, I got the ball 3 times. You know, he needs to feel it out a little bit more. He's also way better in an under center running game. I think in 2019 with Brian Schottenheimer, they were just largely shotgun. Shotgun.
Oh, Shotty.
Yeah. I think Shotty's a good OC, by the way. I just think that particular scheme did not fit Rashad. He was like in a lot of single back formations at San Diego State. And then immediately just comes to a shotgun team. It was like, well, there you go. That was part of the issue. So I think the scheme fits him a little better now. And I think that one thing that did click that wasn't hitting him before, he's like, dude, you're 236 pounds. Like, you don't need to dance. If you see anybody with a single-digit jersey in front of you or anything in the 20s or 30s, put your shoulder down, you know, and just go through that dude. You don't got to dance at 236. 236 is you run through guys. And I think that did click for him last year.
One of our cliches in the fantasy world is, you know, we can handle this backfield if it's a 2-man backfield, but if it's a 3-man backfield, that starts to get pretty dicey. And I think particularly with the Seahawks, Penny and Walker are both not pass catchers. So if they're splitting a 2-down role and then a third guy like DJ Dallas is coming in for passing downs, I think that's going to be pretty tough. But do they trust Rashad Penny enough to, as a pass protector, to maybe have this be a 2-down or a 2-man committee? Or, you know, are we going to see kind of a dedicated third down back in the mix as well?
The latter. Yeah, that's dangerous from a fantasy perspective too. Because like Rashad, and let's say Kenneth Walker's a decent pass protector. I don't believe he is. I haven't seen enough of it. But guys who carry the ball that much in college typically aren't. Let's say he's decent. Let's say Rashad's decent. Either one of them is better than Travis Homer or DJ Dallas, right? And that's the priority on third down. Keep the quarterback upright. You know, Chad Morton, the running backs coach, tells me all the time, he'd be like, hey, man, I don't care how well you can run the ball or catch passes. If you can't block, you don't stand next to number three. And that was obviously when Russell was the quarterback. The same principles are going to apply, I'm pretty sure. Chad's pretty consistent in that way. So, yeah, you're going to see Rashad run the ball on first down, second down, or Kenneth run the ball on first down, second down. And then, yeah, Travis is coming in. DJ Dallas is coming in. Travis is a really good pass protector. Probably one of the better backs at it in the league. You know, I think him and Derrick Henry are just nails at pass protection for different reasons. So, yeah, that makes it really tough to trust in Rashad and Ken as well, just because they won't get much third. They're almost like you can't count on them to catch more than, I don't know, maybe 12 balls each a year, which doesn't do you any good.
Well, Michael Sean, thank you so much. We know you're very busy. We were very, very thankful you agreed to talk to us during training camp.
It doesn't start till Wednesday, so
I know, but I didn't know if, like, you know, I just imagined, like, the second we get, like, anywhere near training camp, like, a beat writer's life just becomes pure chaos. But so I'm glad you're getting a little relaxation before Wednesday, but we appreciate it so much. Awesome, awesome stuff from Michael Sean Dugar at The Athletic. And but you have a podcast too, Seahawks Man to Man, correct? You have a radio show too, correct? 9 to 11 Saturdays on 93.3 KJR, I'm assuming, in the Seattle area.
Yeah, well, just the podcast for now. We had to cut the radio so short because I'm going to get too busy during training camp. I just got to prioritize the main gig for now. But, yeah, Seahawks Man to Man podcast on Apple, on Spotify, on The Athletic. We're also on YouTube, Seahawks Man, number two man. That's our YouTube channel. It's same guys do the radio show, me and my partner Chris Kidd. So check us out there. We're talking about a lot of the same stuff we talk about on the radio anyway. We're going to be weekly during training camp in terms of schedule show releases, and then we go to bi-weekly during the season.
Well, we were really thankful when you showed up on the Seahawks beat too. So there's good Seahawks beats, but it seemed like a little kind of undercovered for a few years. And you've been a huge addition for us here at RotoWorld and an oft-cited presence. So we appreciate the great coverage. Check out Michael Sean at Mike Dugar on Twitter. And Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mike Sean.
So that was Michael Sean. Before that was Matt Maiocco. Now it is Pat and Pat. We're going to talk the Rams and the Cardinals. I wish there was one of these teams that was just a throwaway team, so we could rush the room to end the pod. But both pretty interesting teams. And we'll be right back to talk about them after this. Just a reminder, if you don't have the NBC Sports Predictor app powered by PointsBet, go download it now. The contests are free and easy to play, and you have a shot to win thousands by predicting what will happen in Major League Baseball on the PGA Tour and on the NASCAR circuit. We also have a special contest on Tuesday and Thursdays called Battle of the Bets, where you can agree or disagree with our experts for a shot to collect some cash. Pat, so yeah, it's you and me now. Talk to Rams. And they don't have as many questions as the San Francisco 49ers or the Seattle Seahawks, but for a Super Bowl winning team, they do have some questions. But I have a question because, you know, last Thursday we did an underdog best ball draft live on our podcast, you, myself, our resident Zoomer, Kyle Dvorchik, and everyone basically about had to get like the vom bag when I took Cam Akers in the second round. And this is my first question about the Rams is what is up with the Cam Akers resistance in sharper fantasy circles? What is the case against Cam Akers in fantasy this year?
I think the case against him, and I just to go back to your stunning selection of Cam Akers in the second.
It's like we hit like super severe turbulence and everyone's like looking for the barf bag. I got like, we made a graphic on Twitter and everyone's like, oh, who's this moron? And I'm like, well, I'm RotoPat.
Yeah. Well, what's so funny about that to me is I believe you were out of the 211, you know, that you were drafting out of what, the 102. So you had the 211 or something. And so the fact that you took him there instead of waiting in the third, like, made a huge difference for us fantasy degenerates, because you're like, you would have come back. So that's I think that created as much strife, you know, in the Twitter replies as anything, because I do think I agree with you that I think his ADP will move up. He's, you know, often falling to the late fourth, mid fourth ADP right now. And I think that'll probably move up some if he has a strong training camp. I think the concern with Akers is last year he was a very difficult player to rank. He was kind of in that like 1-2 turn area, but it felt like we're baking in a lot of optimism for this young player, you know, potentially in a workhorse role, but unclear how much receiving work he would really get. And he has not been all that strong of a receiver. Yards per out run of 1.14 as a rookie, 1.13 in limited action last season. That's not bad, but it's not like he's this kind of clear-cut three-down workhorse when he's healthy. And then he just didn't look good coming off the Achilles, which obviously was one of the fastest Achilles returns we've ever seen. So, you know, you can definitely not take that as like an indictment of his talent level anymore. But at the same time, he's still going to be fairly fresh off an Achilles tear. It's like usually kind of a 1.5-2 year injury. So entering the season, is he going to be even a complete bell cow rusher, or is he going to be in kind of a committee with Daryl Henderson? Are they going to be feeling things out? Like, is there a chance that Daryl Henderson actually takes over as the starter if Akers looks like he did in the playoffs? Okay. So, you know, I think maybe there is, because they phased out.
I'll get into that in a second. I don't think Sean McVay likes Daryl Henderson.
I get the same.
Kind of the major problem. And you can finish your Akers talk there, but we'll get into that then.
Well, I just think there's some uncertainty, and then you worry about, like, I do worry a little bit about the upside in the sense of, like, this is a good passing offense, not one that isn't going to need to involve an okay running back in the passing game all that frequently. Like, he's not Christian McCaffrey. He's not going to be running, like, option routes from the slot and stuff. He's going to be mostly a dump-off guy, and this isn't a team that's going to need to dump off all that often, most likely. So the receiving upside isn't super, super juicy. And then you're also dealing with this uncertainty about the Achilles. That said, I mean, you can definitely see him paying off a mid-fourth ADP like pretty easily, you know, especially in half PPR and stuff. So I think he's a pretty good pick where he's going right now. And I do think he'll move up some.
I mean, it does make me feel like a sucker to say like someone coming off a torn Achilles has like stratospheric upside, but like, just the way – so we said the Rams coaching staff doesn't like Daryl Henderson. They seem to just still be head over heels for Cam Akers, as evidenced by the fact that they gave him 67 playoff carries, despite the fact that he was still clearly playing on, like, one leg.
Yeah, it was pretty nuts. I agree.
And I think, like, the positive case there is you mentioned they still, like, fairly fresh off the injury, but, like, he's got – I feel like he's got something that's, like, totally priceless where – we know it kind of like the final step when you're coming back from like a torn ACL or a torn Achilles is like regaining that trust in your leg. And now Cam Akers knows that he trusted his leg in the NFC Championship game and the Super Bowl. And he didn't have to spend his offseason kind of like psyched out about like, you know, where's my leg at? Like, you know, am I going to be able to come back? Am I even still be able to run? You know, where you would hope that he at least reestablished his trust in his leg during that playoff run. Again, the production was not there. And it was like never there. So all four games of the playoff run, he really was not effective. And it wasn't like the numbers were dragged down by like two bad performances. He kind of went like 4 for 4. Pretty uninspiring performances. But this coaching staff seems to have so much trust and love in him. And just now, yeah, knowing that he like cleared that mental hurdle, you know, I'm assuming that maybe he hasn't. Maybe he's psyched out that he didn't run well in the playoffs.
I kind of like this narrative, though. I mean, that's a really interesting point. Like, you know, he did, although it wasn't that great, he did have this stint of getting out there playing playoff football.
Yeah, you don't usually get to work out the kinks in the Super Bowl.
Yeah. So he should have full trust that he, you know, he can do everything he needs to do on the Achilles.
And just the Daryl Henderson, you know, like Sean McVay, like last summer – made a lot of like little comments like, I don't know. Can we trust Daryl to stay out there basically? And we don't know if we can trust Daryl for a 3-down role. And then like the eve of the season, they acquire Sony Michel, and that was, Daryl was better than Sony Michel. Daryl should have played more than Sony Michel did. I think when did Sony's big touches come? I think kind of like down the stretch.
They kind of phased out Daryl. I think they,
and Daryl got hurt then too.
Yeah. I think my read of it was that they decided they preferred Sony, but then they didn't bring back Sony. So,
yeah, I just don't think. And, you know, Jordan Ronrique, a really excellent Michael Sean Dugar's coworker of The Athletic, recently wrote that the sense is that the Rams hope for fifth rounder Kyren Williams to eventually take over the Daryl Henderson role in the offense. And we know eventually can very quickly become like now in football.
Well, I think eventually might mean eventually.
Because I was still like a little troubled by that report when it's like there's a team that's kind of like giving you like a little indication they don't love the player, and you've already got a plugged in media member like reporting that, yeah, you know, they kind of hope this guy replaces that guy. They're kind of always obliquely hinting they don't even like. And I just think Daryl Henderson could be like almost like a non-entity this year. But I understand the Cam Akers fading. I think it's going to be like kind of like a pivotal Cam Akers, I think, is going to be kind of like a pivotal, like hinge point player where I don't feel like he'll like his ADP will end up just right. He'll probably either end up being severely underdrafted or severely overdrafted. And I just think he's going to be like a very, very important player in fantasy.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think he could easily, you know, kind of turn in like a James Conner type season, or he could have like a Joe Mixon.
Well, he's apparently you're the sharp drafter's god, James Conner. So why aren't you more into Cam Akers?
Well, James Conner was the sharp drafter's god when he's going in like the ninth round or 10th round last year. but I, you know, point being that even from the fourth round, that kind of season, a touchdown driven season, I think Cam Akers probably going to need to get in the end zone a bunch of times to really hit, but he's in an offense where that can 100%
happen. He probably will.
Yeah. So it's not the most exciting upside scenario to think through, but it's still plenty of upside for where he's going. So it's one of those things where maybe a little bit of a blind spot for the sharp drafters where we want to dream a little bigger, but it's probably big enough.
I think there could be big. I mean, they dialed off the run in the second or the off the pass in the second half of the season last year after that Matthew Stafford interceptions bonanza. I mean, Sean McVay, as we all know, is always more conservative than we're hoping. And I just feel like it's not being considered enough that Cam Akers could just have like a monster fantasy season, but
yeah.
He also, could also
maybe
be very bad.
Maybe degenerate drafters is how I should describe our cohort. Right?
And you know, I will end up losing this argument, I'm sure.
No, I like it. I think
I don't like flag planting on Achilles guy, but no offense to Cam Akers, but it's an uncomfortable place to be all in on a guy, the torn Achilles guy.
Well, Achilles are interesting because like we did see Demaryius Thomas came back from an Achilles tear, and
he's like the only one. I mean, it took Deontay Foreman like 3 years.
Yeah. There does seem to be there was someone else who came back pretty quickly, and then it just
Michael
like,
Crabtree really... did.
Okay.
But he came back. Michael Crabtree was ruined. He was the first guy that he came back after like 6 months. Everyone was like, what? You know, I didn't even know that was like a thing that could happen with the Achilles, but we'll see. He's going to be a very interesting player. The point is, yeah, the Cam Akers is going to be an important player this summer, whether you're fading him or in on him. I feel like he's going to be like a fateful player. Another potentially fateful player, Pat, is Allen Robinson, who I wrote somewhere that the Bears essentially dared Allen Robinson to quit on the season last year, and he took them up on it, basically. And very toxic relationship between Allen Robinson and the Bears. And then hopefully a very good relationship between Allen Robinson and the Rams. The Rams pounced on Allen Robinson in free agency. Just how much are you buying in to an Allen Robinson bounce back in this Rams offense?
So I'm really struggling with Allen Robinson in drafts because he's pretty expensive and he goes near a lot of other players, not just wide receivers. But there's a lot of wide receivers I like in the range he goes more than him. There's a lot of players at other positions that I like more. So it's tough for me to draft him. But at the same time, this could be a really valuable role, a role that scores a lot of touchdowns. You know, he could, it's obvious kind of red zone weapon. And then also the number two wide receiver has been pretty valuable touchdown scoring role in this offense. So I don't want to be completely out on Robinson. I'm taking him sometimes when I've taken Cup, but then I'm like, well, if I'm right about Robinson not really being that great of a pick, do I want to ruin all my Cup teams? You know, like this stacking thing might be bad if you're not a big Robinson guy. So
you're too at well, he's free.
Yeah. So if you're not in on Robinson, are you in on Van Jefferson? Cause like someone's going to score. So I've been drafting a lot of Tyler Higbee.
Oh no. I was going to say that as a joke.
he's going like as one of the last, he's going just ahead of like Hayden Hurst and Austin Hooper, way behind Everett, not way, but like significantly behind, like almost I think around
People are fed up. They've been fed up by Tyler Higbee.
They don't like that he drops the ball and kind of just falls down when he does catch it and can't score a touchdown to save his life. I don't know what it is, but this came out. But I think for an extremely cheap price tag, he's interesting. And then the other reason that I'm slightly nervous about drafting Robinson is Odell Beckham still seems like his most likely landing spot seems to be the Rams.
Seems like they can't stop talking about that either side. Almost like a Gronk, like Bucks thing. Like it just seems like everyone, not Gronk this year, but kind of like everyone just thinks eventually he's just going to be back with the team.
And yeah, I do. So if you think about like Robinson in these, tournament style drafts where really what matters is doing well weeks 15, 16, 17, and particularly 17, is Robinson even the number two guy, or is Odell Beckham back with the team and pretty much healthy, healthy enough to kind of ruin your Allen Robinson selection in like the fourth round? It's not like he's cheap. So
I know the upside has been kind of like immediately repriced back into his ADP he's not getting like a Kenny Galladay discount. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. If he was getting, even if he was getting like a Michael Thomas discount or something.
True. Because Thomas was kind of on the wide receiver 3-4 borderline right now, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even DK Metcalf. Yeah. Like I'm getting DK Metcalf after Allen Robinson. Like, I don't know. It's tough.
Yikes. That's insane. But so real quick, we vaguely mentioned Cooper Kupp. So we know Cooper Kupp, he had the second greatest receiving season of all time after previously only clearing, I don't think he'd ever cleared 1,100 yards before last season. Safe to say, I think there will be some regression from Cooper Kupp this year, but are you still comfortable with Cooper Kupp as say like the unquestioned wide receiver one overall? Or are you trying to sneak someone like Justin Jefferson or Ja'Marr Chase in there?
This is one of those things where I think you do want good exposure to Kupp, Jefferson, Chase, and Jonathan Taylor and Christian McCaffrey. So like figure out how you're going to do that. But I don't think going underweight on any of those guys makes any sense at all. And you're in a position this year where like Chase will sometimes fall to the sixth or seventh spot. Jefferson, you've kind of got to take him where he goes normally at fourth, but he is almost always there at fourth. So you don't have to, you don't really have to reach for him. And then that's creating a situation where, if you want enough Kupp, that's where it starts to get jumbled. Sometimes we'll see Kupp go two. Sometimes he falls to three, but not always. So it's like, I don't really see any reason to reach for Jefferson ahead of Kupp when very few people are doing that. And sometimes getting exposure to Kupp out of the third spot can be difficult, especially if you're also trying to get the running backs when you have the chance to get those guys. So for me, I guess if I had only one draft to kind of more coherently answer the direct question, I would take Kupp, though. I would take Kupp ahead of Jefferson in my only draft of the season, even though I expect regression is coming for Cooper.
It is coming. It's
3.12 yards per outrun. 3.12 is like bananas off the charts. Like a whole, like 2.12 would be awesome, right? 3.12 is insane. So yeah, there's going to be regression, but including the playoffs, he had 2,425 receiving yards.
A lot of yards.
Last season. So, he'll regress. He had 22 touchdowns, including the playoffs. Like, we'll deal with the regression when it comes. You're still getting the favorite to be the wide receiver one in fantasy, a guy who's shown to be a superstar, incredible connection with Matthew Stafford. No reason to doubt the potency of this offense going forward. If anything, they're potentially going to be better off if they bring Beckham back. To close the year, they might just be kind of an unstoppable passing game. Maybe that helps Stafford play a little bit more consistently than he did down the stretch. When we actually saw with Stafford throwing pick sixes that they went a little bit more towards the run. So, maybe these additional weapons help Stafford keep the foot down on the pedal on the passing game.
The pedal to the metal.
Pedal to the what's that? If we get more passing attempts because of more weapons, then that's gonna help everybody.
You want a true alpha build? The skip Cooper Kupp in the first round, go Cam Akers. I think that's wow. The highest T possible build you could ever have.
Akers 101.
Akers 101. Yeah, people are saying I took him that he fell way too far. Actually, in our underdog draft.
Everyone's saying that.
Everyone's, people were tweeting at me. Someone came up to me. I was in Chicago over there. Someone came up to me on the street and said that to me. Yeah, people are.
Was
saying,
it Cam Akers?
Did you yeah, it was Cam Akers. He was there with his family, getting in some R&R before training camp. And real quick, before we move on to the Cardinals, producer Adam shares the tidbit: the Cup is the co-favorite to lead the NFL in receiving yards with Justin Jefferson, per odds from Points Bet. So it is weird. You got Justin Jefferson going into a Rams type system, and Cooper Kupp coming off what was probably the best possible year you could have in the system. So it just will be very interesting how things shake out between those two guys. And we'll be right back after this for some Arizona Cardinals talk. Prep for your draft with the latest player rankings, projections, and more in the NBC Sports Edge Fantasy Football Draft Guide. Plus, it is powered by this little old website called RotoWorld, the premier source for player news and fantasy information. Take advantage of our preseason special and get the draft guide for $5 when you use promo code DRAFTGUIDE at checkout on NBCSportsEdge.com/draftguide. I didn't ask you if you had any final thoughts on the Rams, Pat, but I think you tied them up pretty well. And got to get some.
I had a whole another 5 minutes on Higbee, but we can move on.
On Ben Skowronek. And then, you know, Kyren Williams, we didn't even really get into it. Yeah, Kyren Williams, we got a lot, just pages and pages of notes and Kyren Williams. But the thing I'll ask you about the Cardinals, is there another gear for Kyler Murray to take? I mean, this is kind of like a real football guy question, but he's always like around the QB three or four. He's faded really badly the past 2 years, either due to injury to himself or to his supporting cast. Do you think this is like who Kyler is in fantasy, which is very valuable? Or do we think there's another gear for Kyler Murray to take in fantasy this year?
I definitely think there's another gear. I think with Kyler Murray, you have to understand that he's not going to be elevated by Cliff Kingsbury. Cliff Kingsbury, I think, is a pretty poor coach. Like he's not like, you know, in the, like the very worst coaches in the league, but yeah, but he's also like probably what, one tier above that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And yeah, he's done some interesting stuff in terms of like run play design, but they don't seem to be creative in the passing game. So what's going to elevate Kyler Murray is talent around him. And I think DeAndre Hopkins going out last year really hurt. And then also he dealt with this ankle injury last season, but when he was really at his best last year, he was awesome. Through the first 8 weeks of 2021, he ranked second in completion percentage over expected, so he's super, super accurate. He's also fifth in EPA per play. I think this season with Marquise Brown there, they have a connection obviously from their college days, and Brown, you know, not a complete receiver, but very good downfield threat. I think that could really help Murray kind of regain some of that early season form. But then really once Hopkins returns from his suspension, this is a really impressive group of weapons around Kyler Murray with Marquise Brown, DeAndre Hopkins, Rondale Moore probably out of the slot, or maybe they're kicking Hopkins into the slot some.
And so hopefully Rondale Moore is not getting Trey Sermoned. I have a little concern about that.
There's a chance. Yeah, the Moore stuff, I'm sure we'll get to him, but you know, he'll have an audition here. So we'll kind of know who he is once Hopkins gets back. And you know, if he gets Trey Sermon, he's probably not very good. But yeah, I think Murray does have a chance to regain that form being healthy. And I mean, I think it's a big deal if Marquise Brown, you know, is a very strong deep threat in this offense, as I expect him to be, because where Hopkins is at in his career, he looks more like he's a possession receiver at this point. His ADOT had been declining in Houston, and then he came to the Cardinals and he was used on a lot of shorter throws. He wasn't really a downfield guy. Last season he was going downfield more often. He wasn't drawing targets at all that high of a rate. I think the offense needed him to be that guy, but that doesn't suit this version of Hopkins, who I think he's lost a little bit of a step since his glory days. That's not the best fit for him. But with Marquise Brown in that role, and Hopkins being this really kind of reliable intermediate guy, I think Murray really could regain that form from last year as a passer. And then obviously we know that he's a really capable rusher as well, and could easily, I think, finish as the quarterback one if these weapons play to the level we think they can.
Well, that's a point I've been trying to make to people about Marquise Brown, is like there's maybe a perception that Kyler Murray has had deep threats, but like you said, DeAndre Hopkins' game was already changing, and he's the kind of deep threat that will make a contested catch now. But like, that's not a great deep threat formula. And Kyler Murray's never really had a deep threat that just like runs right by people. You know, like Christian Kirk never really did that. Like a lot of these other guys never really did that. And Marquise Brown, so Kyler Murray, as we know, has like just a massive arm, and he's finally has a deep threat that will, he's Marquise Brown's the kind of guy who just like runs right by people. And it could be a totally new dimension to Kyler Murray's game. And
Murray has a great deep ball. Like for all the stuff about, you know, the horizontal raid, which, you know, that's not on Kyler, that's on Cliff. But the thing is, like, there's not a ton of intermediate throws in the offense. We see a ton of short throws in the offense, but Kyler throws deep and he throws deep well. So if you've got Brown streaking down the sideline wide open, Murray will hit that throw. And yeah, I think, you know, to put some numbers to the DeAndre Hopkins stuff, his ADOT in 2020 with the Cardinals was at 9.0, which is the lowest of his career, down a yard, 1.8 yards from 2019 at 10.8, which was also the lowest of his career to that point. So consistently trending down in terms of his average depth of target, not earning those deep targets anymore at a super high rate. Last season, back up to 13.1, which was his highest since 2017. So they kind of made him be old, you know, kind of prime DeAndre Hopkins.
Wasn't didn't go working out very well. No.
No.
So it's just Kyler, too, just stay healthy, man. He was the QB12 as a rookie. He was the QB3 as a sophomore by average points. Then QB5, just faded with the shoulder injury in 2020. Then faded, yeah, with the ankle last year. He averaged 22.1 points during the fantasy playoffs. That was over five fewer per game than the average before getting hurt. Like, he was having kind of like a legendary year before he got hurt. So I agree with you that there's another gear that he's come like tantalizingly close to putting it all together. And
he's treated in drafts like he's closer to Jalen Hurts than, you know, to Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes. Like, and I don't agree with that assessment. I think he could be the quarterback one this year if he puts it together. And he's got the weapons to do so down the stretch.
So speaking of the weapons, I mean, Marquise Brown, he's the wide receiver 16 on underdog right now. Is that too high, too low? Just for, I mean, it's very, very bullish, very aspirational ADP right now for Marquise Brown. It won't be that high, I feel like, in like normal person, quote unquote, redrafts, but it's going to be high. Does that feel right to you for Marquise Brown's ADP?
It does feel a little bullish. I think there's a couple things going on in early drafts. One is that all the wide receivers are a bit pushed up right now. The people drafting early are generally not drafting a ton of running backs early. And Marquise Brown, if you don't have, you know, let's say you do draft a running back and you're kind of going anchor running back, he's kind of an interesting guy to add to those types of builds as well, because he's going to start hot. And so, you know, you can, it's like, okay, if I don't have a ton of wide receivers so far, you know, I'm going to get this guy who's going to be putting up points right away. But if you're going zero running back, starting hot is one of your issues. So it's like, okay, I'm loading up on wide receivers, but I still find this appealing that I'm going to get Marquise Brown starting hot out of the gate, because I'm not going to be starting all that hot at running back out of the gate. So I think kind of appeals to a lot of different structures at the moment. And then you also have Kyler Murray's ADP kind of lining up pretty well, where you can kind of target Murray coming back in the fifth if you have taken Marquise Brown in the late third or early fourth. So like, there's sort of these structure reasons in drafts, I think, that make him make sense at that 3-4 turn. Purely from like, who should we be drafting, it does feel a little early,
a little high
for Marquise Brown.
little high. And so then you said you wanted to talk about this player. I wanted to talk about this player. Someone I feel like will end up going a little high himself, Rondale Moore. What's the Rondale Moore spiel? Where he had a few like kind of crazy compiling games as a rookie, or at least from a targets perspective, not necessarily from an actual production perspective, but it seemed like the coaching staff didn't really know what to do with him. And just what is your feel on Rondale Moore for 2022? Who could be, I mean, there could be like so much untapped upside there, or there could just be a lot of downside and a passing attack that's just not very well schemed.
So one thing I will give Cliff Kingsbury credit for last year was that I think he probably made the right call once Hopkins went down, because there was two paths. One was to put Christian Kirk on the outside and put Rondale Moore in the slot, And then you've got, I think, probably your three best wide receivers on the field in A.J. Green, not in that order, but in A.J. Green, Christian Kirk and Rondale Moore. Instead, he had Antoine Wesley out there ahead of Rondale Moore, but that allowed them to put Christian Kirk in the slot. So they basically kind of broke a tie towards Wesley over Moore in order to take their best receiver who was left after Hopkins got hurt and have him where he's best. Christian Kirk, I think, is definitely best out of the slot. So they optimized for him to be running his routes out of the slot. That didn't leave anywhere for Moore because he can't really play on the outside. I mean, maybe 3-4 years he adds that. But as a rookie, he's a slot guy. He probably will be a slot guy for his entire career.
Doesn't necessarily have outside size.
No.
Rondale Moore.
He does not. So, yeah, you're looking at, like, a guy who just kind of got boxed out in terms of playing time. And I think that helps explain why he had an 8 out of 1.3. He's basically being used as, like, a running back in terms of, you know, the types of routes and the role that he had in the passing game. I'm not overly concerned about that. First of all, he's actually pretty efficient at 1.65 yards per route run.
I see a twinkle in your eye.
Pretty good. Like, it's not incredible, but it's not like he bombed in terms of what he did when on the field. He flashed a little bit. So can he get a consistent role in this offense? To start the season, they almost have to, like, work things so that he intentionally does not. I mean, it would be really weird if they had Marquise Brown, A.J. Green, and Antoine Wesley as the starting three guys, because no one's really a natural slot receiver with those three. So it would make all the sense in the world to have Rondale Moore starting out of the slot consistently for those first six games. If he's good, and he's flashed some real talent, some real yak talent, you know, guy who can make plays with the ball in his hands, type of receiver. I mean, once you get the ball in his hands, the size maybe isn't such a weakness. You know, it's kind of a little bowling ball type of dude. So, you know, I think he could be fun out of the slot. If he's not playing out of the slot after those six games, it's probably because he didn't play very well. So he's going to get a legit shot to show that, you know, he does have second round talent.
We very briefly mentioned James Conner earlier, but James Conner, yeah, I mean, I feel like going back to the James Conner this well kind of feels like hitting on 17 and blackjack, where he stayed healthy, which he does not usually do. He converted a ridiculous amount of goal line carries. And people, I just feel like, are kind of drafting him like it's the new normal, like on the RB1-2 borderline. And are you having any part of that?
I was taking him a little bit, and then I wrote our Cardinals team preview. And in writing the team preview,
you looked, like, under the hood more than you had.
I did. Because it was one of those things where, like, I was taking a lot of James Conner last season. You know, Daigle and I did our fight pod, which
you did.
Took a little extra promo here for the expo. We will be doing the fight pod live at the expo this year. So that we're running that back. And I'm happy to run it back, since one of the big fights that we had was Chase Edmonds versus James Conner last year, and I had the Conner side. So, you know, he was a guy that I was very happy about. You know, I have good feelings in drafting James Conner. Was kind of leading that to maybe take him a little bit more than I should at first. Looking into it, I mean, he's so touchdown dependent.
You know, crazily so. Just crazily, crazily so.
And if you look at what they've done, they didn't really add – that much. They had Daryl Williams, but Daryl Williams, like, if he's not cut, then the only reason to have him is to have him out there for passing downs. And he's a reliable guy. He can, you know, he can take dump offs, he can pass protect, etc. If it's not Daryl Williams, I think it might be Eno Benjamin, who's kind of in somewhat of that role. But the signing of Daryl Williams was a signal, I think, that they want probably someone in that type of role. And so if that is the case, then Conner is going to be very touchdown dependent yet again this season. And at this price, that's a difficult bet. Now, he has started to drop a little bit. I've seen him in the fourth round. And, you know, if you're looking at him versus Cam Akers, as I said before, like, maybe a similar bet. You're basically betting who can score the most touchdowns and mostly a two-down roll here. I don't think that's too bad. But, you know, in the third round, I started to get a little queasy.
It just kind of seems like an easy fade for a guy who – he's 27 now. He's really never been an efficient rusher. He's had a lot of trouble. Last year was the first time he ever appeared in more than 14 games, and it was only 15. He still missed two games. And, you know, guys are injury prone, quote unquote, until they're not. Maybe it was this fluky bad luck before, but yeah, a guy who's never been that efficient and an offense where we don't, we're getting, that is a weird thing about Cliff. He's better at designing the run game for some reason than the passing game, which was not good to his reputation coming into the NFL.
Weird, right? Because he actually kind of is good at designing run plays.
He has been since he got the NFL. It's very strange. They've had like creative running games, but James Conner, I mean, to me, it just feels like an auto fade. It's kind of like a paint by numbers fade. And sometimes people then like fade too much, but they haven't been fading him too much. Like,
well, where would you be interested in him?
Nowhere. Just straight up nowhere, to be honest. I mean, I'd rather have Alvin Kamara. I'd rather bet on Alvin Kamara bouncing back. I'd rather bet on Travis Etienne's upside. I'd probably rather have him than Zeke. So I don't know. He needs to fall at least three or four spots. Maybe he was more RB 16, 17 instead of 13, 14. It wouldn't strike me as like so egregious. But I don't know. He's almost certainly I'm going to be letting other people take James Conner this summer.
Yeah, I think if he's still sticking around in the fourth, I drafted him, I think, the other day in that range. That's where I'm starting to be like, okay, now – you know, I'm not paying a ton here, and this feels like a spot where maybe I can just bet on touchdowns, which I
he will be unchallenged. But yeah, he will be unchallenged. Ball, yeah, on the touch on the goal line role, I guess, unless it's Kyler Murray. And he had a 12 touchdown season with the Steelers. It's a role where he has a reputation and has produced results as a goal line runner. So it's not like
pretty big. Like,
yeah. It
makes a lot of sense for him.
Yeah. It's not like an imagined attribute of his. It's one thing he is like very good at, but yikes. I just don't know. any final thoughts on the Arizona football Cardinals, Pat?
You know, one of the things about best ball is that you do end up drafting AJ Green, and that's probably one of my least favorite things about it. But yeah, I do think that AJ Green, you know, in your Kyler stacks, I think it's okay to tack them on if you feel too nauseous about doing that. I will say I have done it.
Yeah, so like that was some I think some textbook damning with faint praise. If you can tack AJ Green to a Kyler Murray stack, you don't gotta do it, but you could maybe do it.
I just feel like people who like probably draft the same types of players that I do want nothing to do with AJ Green. So I just want you to know, I've done it. It feels gross. It feels as gross as you think it feels. But
you've done it. You're willing to publicly admit it. And I am willing to publicly end this show because it's over. Thank you so much to NBC Sports Bay Area's Matt Maiocco. Thank you so much to The Athletic's Michael Sean Duggar for coming and talking to Seattle Seahawks. Thank you to Patrick Corain for talking about these other teams and to myself for talking about these other teams. I said Duggar against Duggar. I'm so sorry. Michael Sean Duggar. Thank you so much, Michael Sean, for coming and talking to the Seahawks. We'll be back later this week with two more podcasts, Denny Carter on Tuesday. We'll be back next week, I believe, to talk to AFC West. And Crane, we hadn't talked about this yet, but Denny's on vacation next week, so you're going to be running it back on the preview pod next week. So we'll talk to Pat Crane next Monday.
AFC West, I mean, that's the division.
There we go. The Hornet's Nest this year. So for Pat Crane, for Michael Sean, for Matt, I am Pat. We will be back later this week.